Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday morning. It is the 11th of May, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and a delight to have you with us on this sunny day. It's very nice to know that you're there. We have a lot to talk about. We will get right to it. Let me introduce everybody. I'll remind you as well, you can always be a part of the program. All you have to do is email us. It's very simple. Panel at WAMC.org is the magic email that will get you through the system, and you can register your letter there, and we'll get to as many as we can throughout the morning. Roundtable, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, as I screw it up, Alan. Good morning, sir. Alan Chertok is here. How are you?
Well, I'm good. It's a little coolish, but it's going to get warmer, and that's all good. I've been watching Mitt Romney, of all people, trying to figure out how to survive but tell the truth at the same time. And that's a tough one. I wouldn't want to be. He's one right now, although I do like the guy.
Yeah, and it is interesting to see how you get ostracized because you tell the truth, but
because okay. You're doing right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's an odd thing. Well, we also we desperately wanted him here yesterday, and he was nice enough to come today, and I couldn't be more thrilled. Heatherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler is with us. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Morning, Joe. It's nice sunny spring day, which of course means my allergies are in full bloom. So I apologize if I'm a little bit stuffy
right.
today.
We welcome you and your phlegm.
Flemish.
That's right.
I want to make sure because that Jim understands every time I hear he's tetherless, I start to think about getting my tetherball.
Yeah.
Operation.
Yep. Yeah. He's ready. And now the other thing, and Jim will get into this, but you've had a hell of a week.
Well, you know, Joe, I'm now in my fifth day with no email, and I got to tell you, I'm learning to love it.
I bet you are. Well, we'll get into all of that in just a few minutes, I promise. Rosemary Armeo joins us, investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning. I, too, am eager to hear what Jim has to say about the cyber attacks at RPI and elsewhere.
Yeah, there's a lot of news, and we will get to that in a second. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain rounds out the group this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Happy to be here. It's a beautiful day, and I can't wait to hear what everyone has to say.
Yes. Well, we'll get right to it. We can't wait to hear what you have to say in a very wait, don't tell me kind of pitch that I'm going to give by going to our email. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, well, let's start with it. We talked about this story yesterday, and I think I prefaced this by saying, God, I wish Jim were here. And now he is, and there's much more. Well, I say not much more, that we know a little bit more, and we know some of the questions that are more questions that are being asked, some questions are being answered. So the FBI has identified the group behind the pipeline attack. The attack, it was by DarkSide, a relatively new criminal group believed to have roots in Eastern Europe, exposed the remarkable vulnerability of an American infrastructure. This is a pipeline that basically supplied gasoline and jet fuel to the entire East Coast of the United States. And this was a huge ransomware attack. That's the new news, because yesterday many were still blaming it on Russia. Now we hear that it is this group called DarkSide. So, Jim, let's begin with you as to what this is. First, let's begin with what ransomware is and how it can screw up something like this.
Okay, so to start with, what ransomware is I break into a computer, not me, someone breaks into a computer and essentially locks it or steals information or something and says, you can't have that back. You can't use your computers till you give me some money. Usually it's in the form of Bitcoin or some other cyber currency, which makes it harder to track. And it's been used against hospitals. It's been used against cities and towns and universities. So it's a fairly standard kind of attack, and people are getting better at dealing with it as a pure cyber attack. What's both interesting and scary about the pipeline attack, and I've mentioned this before on the show, is we're seeing an increasing kind of attack on what's called cyber physical infrastructure, when we give it a big name. But really all that means is things that are connected to the net but are also not just computers. So for example, the pipeline, the electrical system, water plants. And mostly we've seen to date very small attacks on these things. So this is the first really major attack, and it's coming in the form of this ransomware. It's scary for a lot of reasons. One is because a lot of us have been saying for a long time that these systems are not as protected as much as they should be, and we're certainly seeing that play out. One thing that is interesting is this is the first major attack under the Biden administration, and yeah, they're taking a very different approach. So they've convened people. They're actually using this now to try to create some policies that will essentially tell all of the people who have these kind of cyber physical systems on which our nation depends that they have to start doing some things in the cyberspace to being more protected, reporting what's going on, things like that.
So question, can I, Joe?
Absolutely.
My question would be then, do people pay off? And is there any reason that the government has put up that you shouldn't pay off and can't pay off under consequences of law?
So the answer is no. To my knowledge, there's no law. And I doubt there would be because, you know, think about it like kidnapping, right? Some people insist we should never pay ransom. Some people say if that's the best way to get someone you love back, you do it.
Right.
A lot of it depends on the size and scale. You know, many of the attacks that were made on hospitals and things during COVID were ransomware that didn't ask for a whole lot of money, but it was a lot when you put it together. And that was all believed now to be mostly North Korean hacking, which is another whole story. You know, the other problem is a lot of these groups are peripherally attached to governments. So they're not, you know, you can't say, okay, Russia hacked us. What you can say is a group which Russia has not punished for doing this sort of thing has hacked us, right? In China, you actually can get rewards for stealing information from other countries. In North Korea, they actually have military units that do ransomware to help fund their militaries. So it's becoming a very active kind of thing. In the US, we've been a little bit behind legally. We've actually been pretty good in terms of protections, but people are now beginning to understand we have to really rethink this whole thing.
So when it comes to rethinking this whole thing, one of the words that really struck me in the articles that I've been reading has been the remarkable vulnerability of this system, of this infrastructure, for this pipeline. So we obviously have to rethink that. In this case, do we know what the vulnerabilities were and are?
We sort of know. I mean, you have to be a little careful, right? When you're under an attack, the last thing you want to do is talk about it, right? You've seen enough police shows to know that, you know, when they're trying to find the kidnappers, they never want to say what they're doing, right? And some of these will come out in public. Most of it will only come out sort of either in the deep cyber community or maybe even in the governmental cyber spaces. I'm very happy. I have a lot of friends I can no longer discuss this stuff with because they've been hired by the Biden administration to actually help solve some of these problems, right? At least make them better. But, you know, the real problem we have is, you know, think about physical security, right? Most of us live in a house with locks on the doors and locks on our windows,
mm-hmm.
right? If you bought some really expensive artwork or a huge television, you might put up a little security system, or, you know, if you want, you might put up a better one. If you're a bank, you have armed guards and you have much deeper things. Cyber, people have been treating it like it's all the same thing, that protecting the pipeline is like protecting your front door. And now, you know, what we're seeing is that's not true. And so some of these companies are going to have to put a lot more money into the security of these things than they've been doing in the past. It's a constant battle. You can't just say, okay, we've solved the problem, right? Because new technologies come along that cause new vulnerabilities, and then those have to be patched. So it becomes a very active thing. And just as we need police forces to eventually provide a certain level of protection, you need the cyber people who are really going to be taking good care of your systems and really paying attention to having an appropriate level of cyber defense. Your home computer, you're probably fine with just what's provided. And you talked yesterday a lot about password vaults and things like that. I'm a strong believer in that. But you know, when you talk about real systems like these pipelines, they need a lot more than just password protections that are better. They really need to have very significant systems that are making sure this kind of thing can't happen.
I want to bring in the rest of the group here. Rosemary, thoughts and any questions for Jim?
Where are we most vulnerable now? I have to say that the most interesting part of the story to me was the corporate-like PR statement that the hackers put out saying, look, we have principles here. We don't hack hospitals, for example. Here's how we pick our targets, and here's what happens if you pay and what happens if you don't. So what's the most vulnerable? Would it be the electrical grid? And whatever happened to backups? If the computer systems go out, we really are just dead in the water. There's nothing to go back to the way, however it was, we ran these things before there were computers.
So one is some of the backups are to run these things the way we did before computers. But of course, many of the things we rely on now in our day-to-day life, you know, Joe couldn't reach me yesterday because my email was out, right? The phone would have worked, but Joan didn't have my phone number because we've always used email, right? That kind of thing. So, you know, putting the backup systems in place requires some forethought. In terms of vulnerability, we have lots of vulnerabilities in lots of places. The electrical system is a very interesting thing, and I won't go into my hour-long lecture on it that I give to my security class occasionally, but the fast answer is our electrical system is a patchwork of systems, and some of them are much more vulnerable than others. But the more vulnerable ones tend not to be the biggest, so that's the good news. But again, they're all things that could be broken into. You know, people have been worried for a long time about Wall Street and our financial system. The banks have put a lot of money and a lot of effort. They're probably the hardest thing to hack, just like a bank is a hard thing to rob. But some of the things around it, the e-trading system, some of those are less secure. The water infrastructure, the electrical infrastructure, the road infrastructure, and these pipelines. We've been very aware of these pipelines because if you think about it, imagine if this happened during a time when we had, you know, imagine there was an all-out war going on and you were trying to really bring troops and planes and, you know, military somewhere, and you had this, you know, the pipelines shut down. So, you know, people have been talking about these kind of scenarios for a long time. Here we see it really playing out and people becoming aware that this is not just a science fiction plot.
Mike, we got about 2 minutes. Anything?
Yeah, Jim, I wondered if you thought the government should set up a cybersecurity agency that has standards for major companies and governments and routinely do audits, kind of the way the SEC or the Fed might watch the financial stability of banks or watch over the stock market. I mean, should that be a government role now?
Yes. And the government has a certain amount of that role and does have some places in it. The CISO office, as it's called, Cyber Infrastructure Security Office, was pretty much weakened under the previous administration. That's what one of the things that's building up. So DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is building up a lot, rebuilding their capability in this area. And there's a lot of discussion about what kind of policies we'll see in place. Of course, that gets fought back by the big companies who see how expensive this is going to be. right? It may actually be cheaper to pay ransomware now and then than to actually secure things. And we need to change that kind of thinking.
Let's take a break.
Is this a crime?
Hold that question. So is it a crime? Yes, it is. We'll get into more information in just a second. We'll take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters on this. We have much more to talk about in relationship to this issue and, of course, what's going on at RPI as well. So a lot to talk about. We'll get to all of it in just a moment. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Mike Spain, and, of course, Jim Henler, who's answering the questions. We'll be right back. 9:33 on this Tuesday, May 11th. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So we ended your question, Rosemary, is this legal, right? Or is this illegal?
Well, not as illegal as there has the legal system kept up with the crime. What do you, if they could catch these guys, which with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is increasingly difficult, what would they be charged with? How long would they be put away for? I'm asking this because it does not seem like the legal authority has any deterrence at all.
So there are some fairly strong laws on this. In fact, almost draconian, because they don't differentiate major hacks from minor hacks. There's no equivalent of petty theft versus grand larceny. And so everything is treated like it's grand larceny. The laws that dictate this are out of date, but they're strong. The real problem is a lot of this is international. So again, this is an Eastern European group. Even if we know who did it in a sense, and even if we track down the members of this group and things like that, they would have to be extradited from countries who are, you know, not at the moment friendly with us and willing to extradite and things like that. So that's part of what makes this a more complex thing. Within the U.S., the penalties are fairly high. But of course, like anything else, that's a trade-off, as we see from things going on in some things like these hospitals and things like that. People are willing to take these chances, but also because in the electronic world, it's sometimes a lot harder to track it down. As you said, it's Bitcoin, cryptography, things like that. But even when it is traced to someone, you know, if it's traced to an individual hacker, some high school kid or some grown up, that's pretty easy. And they do end up in jail, and there's a lot of them. But when it's traced to an overseas, a quasi, you know, governmental agency, things get a lot more complicated.
We have letters on this. Get to these here. We'll begin with Tom. I realize that I'm oversimplifying this, but what incentives do large companies have to keep up to date and protect against this type of thing? With the pipeline, for example, gas prices go up and they still have their profits. The consumer ends up paying.
You know, it's a good question, but you know, they pay a large penalty in publicity. They pay a penalty in having to make these fixes if they want anyone to keep using them as the provider. You know, you get into issues of monopolies and stuff. But by and large, the problem to date has been that the cost of fixing this is high compared to the probability of getting hit. But now as that probability is going up, you know, people are starting to take are starting to take measures. You know, I use the example that in the early days, automobiles didn't have any security because who would ever steal a car, right? There weren't very many. You know, once cars were everywhere and there was a major car theft rings, then people started, you know, cars came with locking systems and alarms and, you know, people would buy the club and things like that. You know, it's not a great analogy, but that's sort of where we are now. People are realizing that we're hitting a point in that curve where the costs of not doing this, either paying the ransom or having to redo your system after ransomware or some other kind of attack, is quite a pain, and that you really should be putting stuff up front.
Let's go to this letter from John. I'm a software developer. When I worked on financial trading software 15 years ago, all financial data, all stock trades, etc., went over a completely separate internet, quote unquote, separate dedicated fiber that the telecoms had to keep in separate, tightly secured buildings. All the machines at my employers that connected to the quote-unquote finance internet were forbidden to be connected to anything else, including the public internet. The mouse and keyboard were glued to the machine, and every other USB socket was glued shut. The machines were kept in a separate locked room. All of this was required by federal law. Circumventing any of security measures was subject to immediate firing and potential federal charges. There needs to be a separate non-public networking infrastructure boiled down hard, like what the financial industry does. Comments, Jim?
You know, it's a good point. But again, we get into the cost factors. You know, for the financial industry, you know, it's still estimated there's some percentage of crime, but it, you know, compared to the cost of what it would be if this wasn't going on, you know, again, this is why your ATM works, right? You can put your card in all over the world and get cash because they've put a huge amount of time and effort into securing that. The protocols are kept secret. The systems are somewhat separate, but that comes at a huge cost. And so the question is, you know, how do we, it goes back to that previous question, who's going to pay for all this and how? And we as a society need to come to grips with that.
This letter from Saul. I worked in a mainframe environment for 30 years. Toward the end of my career, we began using servers. Are servers more vulnerable than mainframes?
Not really. One of the things that's changing some of this story is what's called cloud infrastructure. You've all heard of the cloud, but cloud is where you're sort of putting stuff out there. So for example, my Gmail is still working because Google is protecting that. And they put a lot, you know, they're a big enough company, have 2 billion mail accounts. They can put a lot of time and effort into protecting that specifically, as opposed to my Outlook mail, which, you know, even though Microsoft is a big company, it's a frequent target of hacking. So these things, you know, have these trade-offs and things like that. And servers versus mainframes are just how big is your system? Where is it located? How is it protected? And again, there's not really one answer to that. It's right now, it's almost a Wild West. You know, some banks have a guard, some don't. Some saloons, you know, are wide open to the bad guy coming in, and some have Marshall Dillon sitting there. So, you know, we really don't have a good system in place right now, and a legal system that says, you know, this is what you need if you want to be insured, this is what you need if do it. That's changing. There's now cyber insurance out there. There's a lot of other things that you know, are slowly starting to change this, but we as a society really have to come to grips that this is a problem we have to pay attention to.
And this letter from Bill, who says, it's amazing to me that the U.S. is still so vulnerable to cyber attack. The attacks on government agencies was bad enough. Now the pipeline is worse, and I fear that someone could take over a nuclear plant and cause incredible damage. The U.S. needs to get its act together. It is hard to believe that it's still going on, but yes.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. You know, but again, it gets into the whole... you know, it's almost the same thing with things like COVID and vaccines and things like that. You know, in an authoritarian government, you can just say everybody will protect their computer. Everybody will get a COVID shot, right? In a democracy, you have lots of different things at play. In a capitalist system like ours, money has a huge impact. And so, yeah, this is one where we really need to get people from all sides of the political spectrum and the technical people. You know, a big part of the problem, as we're seeing today, is, you know, the education in this is lagging, and it's starting to come along. But, you know, most people who are in the positions that make these policies are just really don't fully understand the technologies and what to do about it. And again, that's slowly changing, but slowly.
All right. We have about 4 or 5 minutes before we go over to a break. And before we do that, let me bring up this somewhat related story, certainly related to you, Jim, and that is the RPI cyber attack, where it has knocked out the computer systems at RPI. So this can't be good. How does this happen? And I assume you're somewhat limited in what you can tell us, but what is going on? Because this happened last week and you're still dealing with it.
So, Joe, I'm limited in two ways. One is that if I did know what was going on, I couldn't tell you. But the other is I don't really know. I'm not in the group that's doing this. We have a very strong cyber group. I've worked with them in a number of things. And we are in a sort of quasi state. So really the issue at the moment is we're keeping a very strong, what's called a firewall. So the outside internet and the inside internet, the connections have essentially been cut. So on campus, you can get to campus things, but you can't from off campus. And email, of course, crosses that, which is why the email systems are down. And slowly they're bringing things back. And largely this is because they're bringing it back very carefully, very cautiously, making sure that whatever is causing the problem is being wiped out. There are also, you know, there's some complaints that they're just not giving out enough information, but that's again because they're in the middle of an active situation and really don't want whatever the assailant or attacker who's doing this to know the exact status of what we know and what we don't know. So, you know, I'm very trusting of our team because I know how good they are, and given how long this is taking, how hard it is, I know it must be a major incident, but, you know, was it targeted or were we somehow caught in, you know, something that came from somewhere else? Is it, you know, something explicitly done? You know, is it suspicious that it happened during finals times? No one knows exactly what's going on. I'm sure after it has been dealt with, we'll get postmortems and we'll learn a lot more. But yeah, this is what it's like to be in the middle of one of these things. You know, your services are substantially done. And as a campus, RPI has probably put more money into securing our system than most campuses. So I was actually a little surprised that with the systems we have in place, with the strength of our cyber guys, and with how much attention we pay to this, that this could still happen.
Do you have students that are smart enough to be able to hack your system?
And wouldn't you give them an A if you got away with this?
I was trying to not say that. No, I mean, yes, but at the same time, most of our students who know enough to do this are also honest enough not to. I would be very surprised if this was an inside.
Yeah.
All right. I wouldn't be surprised if you know, there was some kind of. So another big problem we haven't talked about is a lot of the vulnerabilities come from what's called inside attacks. So insiders, somebody who has access to the system. Often, you know, and again, I don't think this is what's happening at RPI, but, you know, the other problem with these ransomwares and things like that is someone who is allowed in your system and, you know, the disgruntled employee, instead of showing up with a bunch of guns and shooting people, is paid a few bucks by somebody to stick this disc in this place and compromise the network. And so finding those kind of attacks are even harder than finding ones coming from outside. So that's another whole set of issues that we're exploring.
But of course we have 12-year-olds who are chess champions and 10-year-olds who are chess champions. And some kids can do this kind of thing. That's an issue.
We certainly have kids who could do this kind of thing and kids who know this. On the other hand, very few major attacks have had that. You know, when they've tracked them down, it used to be, you know, the myth of the teenage hacker, and that certainly happens sometimes. And, you know, there's a famous hack that shut down the internet many years ago where an MIT student had, you know, a Cornell student, I think it was, had his code got out. He was trying something and didn't realize just how bad it was. He later got hired as a professor at MIT. So that's Rosemary's answer. Yes, he would get an A.
Crime does pay.
This is actually being done by a 400-pound man sitting in his basement.
You know, there have been a few of those, but
in a diaper.
Certainly the pipeline one we know is an organized group. You know, usually an attack on a target like a campus or something, you know, could be an organized group, could be an individual. You just don't know.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more items to discuss. Alan Chartok,
please.
Jim Handler, Mike Spade. We'll take a book, I promise. Rosemary Armeo, we'll be back right after this. Okay, just a couple straggling letters here from the mailbag regarding cyber and cybersecurity, and then we'll move on. This from Ann: is cybersecurity included in the infrastructure bill? That's a good question.
That's a great question. I don't know the answer. I know it's included in some other bills, the National Defense Act and things like that. So I just don't know the answer.
Mark says, without requirements, the profit makers bear the full cost of security. Don't consumers bear the cost of security breaches, much like the fossil fuel industry avoids and passes on the cost of pollution and its impact on public health? So somebody has to pay. It's often us. Is that true?
Yep.
All right. Let's go on to other things as promised, and we'll go. We only have about 10 minutes before our top of the hour break. The big story, of course, is that the FDA has authorized Pfizer for their coronavirus vaccine for adolescents 12 to 15 years old. So the Food and Drug Administration cleared that vaccine for emergency use in kids as young as 12 on Monday, expanding access to the Pfizer shot to adolescents ahead of the next school year and marking another milestone in the nation's battle with the virus. The decision that the two-shot regimen is safe and effective for younger adolescents has been highly anticipated by many parents and pediatricians, particularly with the growing gap between what vaccinated and unvaccinated people may do safely. Evidence suggests that schools can function at low risk with prevention measures such as masks and social distancing, but vaccines are poised to increase confidence in resuming in-person activities and are regarded as pivotal to returning to normalcy. Alan.
The more the better. That's the way I see it. It certainly was what happened with the polio vaccine. Our kids are our most valuable parts of us, and therefore protect them. I've never quite understood why it couldn't be done, but now we have the assurances from the health people that it's doable. So I say full speed ahead.
Rosemary.
It's a good thing. I do think that young people are more realistic than some of us adults, and we'll get into this and popularize it. But I'm not sure what it does for the real big problem with vaccinations, which are the communities of resistors, of anti-vaxxers. And that includes their children. If they're not going to get one for themselves, they're certainly not going to let their children do it. So I hope it'll make a difference. But I think we may have reached that status point where everybody who has gotten vaccinated is or is about to. And the rest are not, and that is a substantial number.
Hmm. Rosemary, how does it not make a difference, even if it's just some? I mean, you're exactly right in what you're saying. Nevertheless, there will be some kids who would pass it on, and if they're vaccinated, they won't get it and they won't give it.
This group is 12 to 16, so they can't do it without parental permission. So it does not solve the anti-vaxxer problem.
No.
And then
no.
The second thing is that it's way more important to have adults vaccinated than children because they seem to get it more. I'm not saying that. Believe me, Rand Paul saying kids don't get it, put them back into school, but they do get it less. And so it's good news. There's no question about that, but it's not a cure-all. I think we still have a problem with trying to get herd immunity through vaccination.
Well, you're exactly right. And, that's another whole story about the anti-vaxxers. I happen to believe that there ought to be legal sanctions, but that's a lonely place for me to be.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you on that.
Mike?
No, I think this is a really good thing. Kids of this age are not, don't often get seriously ill from COVID, they do transmit it to others, and that will cut down on it enormously. But the weird thing is, according to a survey by Kaiser Family Foundation, many parents who went out and got theirs right away are still hesitant to get their kids vaccinated. And that's too bad. We're not talking about anti-vaxxers here. We're talking about people who have gotten the vaccines. They need to be convinced that it's safe. And the FDA data says that it's safe. Safer. I mean, it's even more effective for kids in this age group, and it gives them what they call robust protection. So it's an opportunity, and if people don't take advantage of it, we all lose.
Jim. And you know, I think there's a myth out there that the kids don't get it. Having had one of my friends who has a kid in this age group who got it and was pretty sick, luckily recovered without any serious damage. But, you know, this is a scary thing when your kids get it, and people should be aware that, you know, just because the percentages are lower doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. And school becomes a major place it spreads if people don't get vaccinated.
Rosemary?
Worse may be the myth that thousands of people have died from getting the coronavirus. This is a disinformation being spread by Ron Johnson, that lovely senator from Wisconsin.
You mean getting the vaccine?
The vaccine.
You get a shot and you're going to die. Yeah, you're going to get a shot and you die. Or the other one is you get a shot and you're going to be sterile. You'll never have children. So when you have all of that stuff swirling around, especially coming out of the mouths of people that unfortunately too many Americans listen to and believe, getting shots for your kids is a scary prospect.
Yeah, I mean, another aspect of this is that this is still emergency approval. It isn't the final full approval that the FDA can give. And some people say that's what they need, and that's coming. I mean, Pfizer has applied for it. It should be a couple of months maybe, and they say the others, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, are about to apply for it. And then it can be marketed, and you'll see ads all over TV for it.
Yeah.
You know, one.
Go ahead, Jim.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, you know, one other aspect of this that I was just reading about that's really encouraging is most of the developing world, we have aging societies. But in a lot of the developing world, particularly the global south, you have countries where 50, 60% of the population is children. So being able to get vaccines over there and into younger children is going to make a huge difference in the global spread of the disease, and that impacts the variants that could really come back and haunt us.
And the other thing too, which we probably should mention, is that the lower I forget what it was, I think it was 2 and up to 12 is on the horizon, is expected to come somewhat soon. Right, Mike? I thought they were talking maybe about June, mid-June.
Yeah, well, I read something like, you know, by the end of the year, the fall. But they're already doing tests on them, and they're very positive. And they even are starting in the fall to do tests on kids who are 6 months old or older. And if it became a fully approved vaccination by the FDA, then that would probably just start getting taking place at the pediatrician's office during the 6 month checkup and annual checkup for kids and stuff like that, and this would all go away. But we're away from that, I guess.
Alan, to your point, I mean, my understanding is that the reason that they can't mandate it to go to school is because it is an emergency vaccine, unlike measles and mumps and the other vaccines that you get when you go to school. But if they were to remove that emergency declaration on it, then it could be required, which would help things tremendously.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Universities in the area are requiring it. To Alan's point also.
For students, though.
And SUNY, yeah, for students, exactly, for students, are requiring a shot before you're allowed back on. So why couldn't you do it for elementary schools?
That's a really good question. I know SUNY announced it yesterday. So that is, I don't really understand that difference, but...
Well, the difference is they can't require their faculty and their staff to do it until it has. They don't have the legal authority to impose it on employees until it is fully approved as a regular drug by the FDA. And when that happens, they can do that. There'll be challenges to that, no doubt. But the law is pretty clear. They can require it at that point. They cannot require it now. An employer cannot, according to most legal people.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but for classes, for students, for college students to do it, that is if they want to participate on campus, but they would still have the option if they did not want to get vaccinated to participate off campus. Is that correct?
It could be that. At some places, yeah. But you're right, though, like the state university system, to come on campus, you got to have it. Yeah.
Rosemary?
I at SUNY, I have students who are requesting still to be remote next semester when we're supposed to go back. And the university is saying, no, if it's an in-person class, you have to be there. So that seems to mitigate against it, this idea that you can still pick and choose.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have many more items to discuss, and we will do exactly that. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Jim Hendler, and Mike Spain, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning, the 11th of May, 5 minutes past 10 o'clock. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here, Rosemary Armeo, Jim Hendler, and Mike Spain. We welcome again your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We have some letters on the vaccinations and kids being able to get them 12 and up now. Kathy says, this is interesting. The truth is we don't know, shouty caps, no, how prevalent COVID is with kids. They tend to not have symptoms or the terrible impacts. Given the fact that we now know that the virus is very active in communities for weeks/months before anyone is diagnosed through wastewater analysis, there is a certain implication that children really may be the carriers. That from Kathy. Then we go to this letter from Anthony. Did they have a similar problem of anti-vaccination with the polio vaccine? Anyone?
It took years to get everybody vaccinated, and it was a scary time. But it didn't just happen with it. It took a couple of years. I mean, it was a fight, and kids were the most vulnerable too.
And it was a rough start also. In other words, there were some false starts and there were some problems in the beginning with the vaccine.
Sure.
We haven't seen that here yet. We haven't seen that here yet.
We go to Doreen, who says, in what I think is a step backward, some boards in New York are doing away with Zoom board meetings and going back to in-person meetings. A combination of the two would increase public participation and transparency, but maybe that is unwanted in some cases.
Could be. You never know.
You never know. All right. We'll move on to other topics, and let's talk about there is a date now, and it is tomorrow, that they are expected to take the vote on ousting Liz Cheney from the number three top GOP spot in the House. Republicans would very much like you to know that they are not punishing Representative Liz Cheney because she said mean things about former President Donald Trump. It's not about that. What it is about is focusing on the future rather than the past. Since that became the talking point, though, Republicans, including Donald Trump, have said about reinforcing its speciousness. I think you saw Congressman Cheney giving a press conference and talking about the last election when all of us, the vast majority of members, are talking about the next election, said Steve Scalise. Representative Jim Banks, the head of the Republican Study Committee, also cited Cheney's focus on the past and said her focus on proving her point was an unwelcome distraction. Kevin McCarthy is the latest voice to speak up and has assumed that this isn't about Cheney having voted to impeach Trump. Despite Republicans' claims to want to stay laser-focused on the future and winning elections, though, we've been served repeated reminders in recent days that it's hardly only Cheney who thinks that past is worth relitigating. Trump's new communications platform to combat his bans from Facebook and Twitter has been rightly ridiculed. The platform is, for all intents and purposes, just a blog. But also, have a look at the content of the blog. Trump posted to it 16 times this past week. 9 of the posts rehash a 2020 election that is now 6 months in the past. On Friday morning, Trump promoted a long debunked theory that the votes added to the totals in Michigan in the early morning hours after the election were suspicious. He said, quote, at 6:31 in the morning on November 4th, a dump of 149,772 votes came into the state of Michigan. Trump said 6 months and 3 days after that, quote unquote, dump. But he's not the only one. Representative Elise Stefanik, Cheney's would-be successor as the party's number three leader, who now has the support of Trump, McCarthy, and Scalise, went on a major media tour last week in which she endorsed Arizona Republicans' shoddy recount of the 2020 results. The effort even involved checking ballots for traces of bamboo, the idea being that the ballots might have been dumped en masse from Asia. She also said continuing to scrutinize how states such as Pennsylvania conducted their 2020 election is an important pursuit. I'm not reading from The Onion. I'm reading from The Washington Post. Alan. Yeah.
Political suicide, if I ever saw it. You know, the Republicans are becoming smaller and smaller as a group. The neutrals are fading away, and some Republicans are getting disgusted with the whole thing. So now you have, I think the latest poll I saw was 63%.
Yeah.
Thought Biden was doing a great job. Among the Republicans, low 30s. So they may be, you know, in a sort of circular, what do they call those things?
Yeah, firing squad?
But I was thinking of something a little bit more off color.
I got
but
you.
I didn't do it.
Yeah.
But I think most of us
popular
will understand
it. Popular punk band in the 80s, I believe.
Yeah. Right. So it is political suicide because their numbers keep getting smaller. They're facing an off-year election, which they were predicted to do extremely well in terms of Congress, which they may because of the incredible gerrymandering and vote suppression that is going on. But I doubt it. I don't see how this helps them one bit. But they are all so worried about their individual prospects if Trump comes after them. You even find Mitt Romney going a little bit backwards here to protect himself. That's where we are. It is political suicide, I think.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, I agree, Alan. The Trump insiders reportedly told the Washington Post last week that Trump's actions now are completely motivated by retribution and punishment of those who disagree with him. And it has nothing to do with policy, the future of the Republican Party, the future of the country, all stuff like that. It's just retribution going on. What I find interesting is tomorrow's vote, where they are going to apparently oust Cheney and put in Elise Stefanik as the number three Republican in the House. It's going to be behind closed doors, but it's a secret ballot. When they had a secret ballot back in February, 145 voted for Cheney and only 61 voted to get rid of her. And so maybe more will have guts when they don't have to put their name out there and have to own their vote. And it'll be very interesting tomorrow to see what that number comes out to be.
Well, one wonders what the maybe comes out to be. In other words, one can only be suspicious that the Republicans who are putting all of this together have their ways of knowing who's where. And as you know, with a guy like Donald Trump, it doesn't much matter whether or not they're right or not. You could be dead, politically dead, just because this would-be dictator, suspects them.
Yeah.
Jim.
So, two things strike me. One has been the change in the messaging. Because just 2-3 days ago, McCarthy was on Fox saying, it's because she's out of step. She's not going along with the rest of us in terms of what happened and blah,
she's
blah, blah.
She's not humble enough.
Not humble enough. And then all of a sudden the change was, oh, look, we found a message that isn't as embarrassing, which is that, you know, we're looking to the future, not the past. But of course, you know, then they're endorsing this Arizona nonsense and things like that. Alan, I had a kind of real politic question for you, which is, you know, they're obviously betting the midterms on a right-wing core who will come out as opposed to the middle coming out, and the suspicion that the left wing isn't going to come out as strongly because, you know, sort of the progressives aren't as motivated to keep the current Congress people and stuff like that. Do you see that playing out?
It could be. I mean, you never know. I don't think so. I think we are in such a you know, a divided way of doing our politics, then I think the left will come out. Now, remember that they're trying to hide the voting boxes or to do away with them and to change the voting laws and to do all of that. The question is whether people will resent it and therefore try to overcome it or not. But you know, you may be right. It may well be that people will say, oh, well, the system is fixed. Mm. I hope not.
We now go to Rosemary Armeo.
Okay, well, you all may be right, and this may be completely off base, but I see it slightly differently. I don't think it's political suicide at all, and I am definitely not depending on honorable behavior from Republicans, even when given the gift of anonymity. I think this is another one of those long-range plans to retain power despite demographics going against them. I think it's a three-pronged attack. One was putting in judges that will support their lawsuits. The other is suppression of votes. We're seeing 47 states now who have or are about to consider laws to suppress voting. And the third thing is to gain control in legislatures that certify votes. So what you saw in 2020 will be repeated in 2024, but with a whole different cast of players. Will there be a Pence who will refuse a constitutional duty to certify despite what the president wants him to do? Will there be Raffenbergers in all the Georgias in the state, in the union rather, who will stand up to a president demanding to win? I think this is an extended attempt by Republicans using Trump as their figurehead to retain control no matter what. And so principled people like Lynn Cheney, I can't believe I'm praising her, or Mitt Romney, who I also never would vote for, they come out as heroes, but they're terribly outnumbered and they're being pushed aside. So Elise Stefanik is the future. Liz Cheney is the past, not in the way that we're thinking about it, what people want, but when did our legislature ever really pay attention to what we want? Do we have gun control? Do we have the end of the Electoral College? Name any. Do we have climate measures? No, we don't have any of these things, even though there's huge poll and popular support for these things. This is politics at its worst. I think I'm becoming more cynical. But I find this all very dangerous. I think that what's going on in Arizona is extremely dangerous, and it's easy to make fun of it because it's just like a clown show. And yet it's so serious. And how many states will be doing that in 2024?
Well, I agree with almost every single thing you've said, Rosemary, despite the fact that you seem to think we're not in agreement. I do agree with you, and I do think that that's what they have planned. Whether or not they get away with it, that's the issue.
Yeah, I mean, it gets to that thing about political suicide, and that's the long, I mean, we've been talking about this over the last several days, of the long game and the short game, meaning the short game being how do you do in the 2022 next year's off year elections, and then how do you do and down the road, and I don't know, TBD, I guess, to be determined.
Well, you know, I mean, I get it, and a lot of Republicans who are in Congress are rationalizing this. You know, they don't want to tick off the Trump supporters. They need their money. They need their support to win in 2022. And then after they kind of get control, like Rosemary says, the minority controlling the majority, they'll carry on a very noble agenda that they think is right for America. And that is so specious, it makes me want to throw up.
Well, and the other thing, too, is like you hear, so Donald Trump has just been on the attack
Cheney, yeah.
Well, yes, but of... that other person, Mitch McConnell, and really has been very, very negative towards McConnell while he is beating up on everybody else, and especially, as you mentioned, Liz Cheney. And then for his part, instead of, I mean, I know, I'm not expecting anything more. Please don't think of that I am. But instead of sort of countering that with some sort of argument, McConnell comes out and says, well, we're just going to stop whatever Biden tries to put through.
Yeah, you know, he's getting beat up by Trump, but he doesn't seem to want to defend Cheney or defend anybody who is on his side when he, you know, when he spoke out against Trump's effort to overthrow the election. And yeah, he's just focused on stopping Biden, just like he was when he was majority leader under Obama.
He had something like a 12-point or 13-point approval rating when I last looked.
Yeah.
In other words, people really hate his guts. And nevertheless,
across the country.
Yes. But he keeps winning in Kentucky.
And nevertheless, he does tend to represent those people in his conference, which has always been his thing, and they're not going to replace him with his 12 or 13% popularity, because they want that guy up front doing all the dirty work for them.
Alan, you made reference of this earlier, and I just wanted to talk about the AP poll. 63% of Americans approve of the job that President Biden is doing. 36% of the country disapproves of his performance. That spread of 27 percentage points represents the widest approval margin in a poll since Biden took office. The president continued to receive broadly positive marks for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, with 7 in 10 respondents expressing approval. 57% of Americans said they approved of the job he was doing in the economy, while just 42% disapproved, although the poll was conducted May 3rd before the administration released a disappointing April jobs report. So, I mean, those are numbers you dream of, right?
Right. Believe me, Trump never got over 50%. Think about that. Biden's at 63. Trump never, but he's been hovering around that 30, 35%, sometimes 40% of the American people. So this is supposed to be, I think we credit ourselves with being a democracy. But it's very bad for the Republicans right now. I don't see any way out of it except for their chicanery and their tricks that they're doing with the voting and all the rest of it, and the gerrymandering, which is huge, and a huge way of controlling the Congress. It's going to continue that way.
So if I have this right, Rosemary, as of tomorrow, all three top House Republicans will believe that Donald Trump really won the election in 2020.
Correct. And in 2022, if past patterns hold, they will be in charge of the House and therefore in a position in 2024 to call the shots the way Pence was in this year. So there's definitely method in this. And it is not to kill their party and split it apart. It's to stay in power. Very frightening. And, you know, it's worked in the past. Democrats have never seemed to really awaken to this. When Roe v. Wade passed, we said, we got it. We're set. No, nothing to worry about there. And now abortions are very hard to get in this country because the Republicans dug in, took a long-term look, and went through the state legislatures rather than, and also solidified the Supreme Court, that three-prong attack. They went above and below the level of the Democrats were playing at. It's like they're playing three-dimensional chess, and the Democrats are still stuck on a flat board.
The other poll that I found, I'm sorry, Jim, I wanted your input on that too. I apologize. Did I lose Jim? Has Jim been hacked again?
Sorry, no, I'm here.
Oh, okay,
I'm here.
Good.
Sorry, I was just saying I didn't have anything to add.
Oh, okay.
I have to go on mute when I'm coughing, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, damn allergies. The other interesting poll is that, you know, and you can sort of get whiplash from reading these things, but the political divide in America has grown so deep and so entrenched that it now extends well beyond questions of policy. That's the message coming from a Pew Research Center poll, Alan.
Yeah, look, we are a divided country.
I thought you were going to say Pew. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I'm so sorry. You're exactly right, Joe. I want to apologize. Pew!
There you go. So this question comes that Republicans, 82% of Democrats support voting rights and expanding access to the vote. 38% of Republicans support automatic voter registration and other measures that will increase voting. Only 38% of Republicans believe that people should have, you know, free and open access to voting.
Look, I've talked about this right from day one. This is an attempt to push back against the coming or present majority or potential majority of people of color, Hispanics, people who with less than, you know, much less money than the people who are sitting at the top. And this is an act of desperation. That's why they've got it. But it's only in the 30s. And so despite the fact that they have a Supreme Court now, which is going to legitimize almost anything that they do, almost anything, we've seen that they've been able to say no to a couple of real bad attempts at the electoral system. So it's so easy to understand what's going on here, which is that the minority is trying to do away with the majority one way or the other in an act of desperation. We've seen it before with the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. Go look it up.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's hard to, if you take it out of context and just ask the average citizen, whether they be a Democrat or a Republican, you know, should people have free and open access to voting? You would think, like, the answer is yes. You know, it's hard to believe in a poll that they would actively say, no, not really.
Well, no. I mean, it's all about how you hear the question, though. I mean, to you, it seems so obvious, and to me, it seems so obvious, but when you've already been conditioned by, let's say, Fox News, that the Democrats call it free and open voting, but really what it is an invitation for abuse. And when you hear it that way, then you are skeptical of it. You see, there's
because
an alternative world. Right,
because you
want to
hear it that way.
Yeah, you do. You're open-minded to hearing why free and open elections are bad, and then you sort of embrace that. I mean, we have a disinformation thing going on and a counter-information thing going on, and they're very effective. That's why they're doing that in Arizona. They just want an alternative narrative to tell people.
Exactly.
And that narrative includes bamboo.
Yeah, I know. Well, I heard today, or I saw today somewhere, where they say that Arizona vote is going very badly, and a lot of people who supported it are now saying they're embarrassed by it, and now it doesn't look like it's going to be completed till well into August. So I don't know how, you know, who pays attention to politics in August.
Yeah, that's a good point. Rosemary?
I really wish that what people really wanted in national polls was what we got, but it's so irrelevant. And so free and fair elections are something we all want. On the other hand, the way the Republicans phrase it is, do you want integrity in our system? And hell, I'm for that, too. So it's all in the messaging, and they have the votes in the state legislatures. That's it. The Republicans control the majority of our legislatures, and that's where election laws are made. And Democrats did not see ahead to work there, and the Republicans did. We're paying a price for that, and I'm afraid it's a price that's going to go on being paid for a long time, along with the Supreme Court. I look back, it's easy to do that, you know, and see the Monday morning quarterbacking what we should have done. But to let Merrick Garland's seat go without a fight was wrong. And we're paying for that now. To let Comey go ahead and talk about Hillary Clinton in the way that sounded like she was guilty after he was saying, no, she really is not going to be charged. That was wrong. And this is all the precedent. We are... The Republicans have lost, and yet they still seem to be winning. And that's infuriating to me.
Yeah.
So all of those people saying, oh, move on to the future. No, we are entrapped by what's happened in the future. And it will have what we've done in the past, and it will have an effect on our future, a bad one.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, Alan, I was thinking about that the other day, that you read the paper and you start complaining about everything, and then you realize, oh, yeah, but we have a Democratic president. We have a Democratic House. We have a Democratic Senate. I know there's
for now,
but it's hard to, you know, it's hard to, like, see that sometimes because of all that's going on.
Well, Joe, Rosemary makes a very good point. We are playing by two separate sets of rules. The Democrats say Marcus de Queensberry rules, and the Republicans say kick him in the kishkas no matter what and take advantage of it.
No rules in a knife fight.
Right. That's score one for the word kishkas. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have more items to discuss in our moments left in our time together. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Jim Henler, and Mike Spain make up the panel this morning. We welcome your letters in our remaining time. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this break from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable on this Tuesday morning. We have about 15 minutes left with our terrific panel, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Jim Henler, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. A couple letters here left. David says, the more outrageous the Republican Trumpian actions to steal future elections, the more the left will be motivated to show up to vote in the midterms. The public sees this. The organizers here in Virginia are tired but not complacent. Damn the torpedoes. We will get to the polls. Then we go to Jen, who says, I don't think many of the congressional Republicans believe Trump won the election. A member of the House was on one of the Sunday shows this weekend and said that he believes that only five House Republicans actually believe the lie. The rest are just willing to go along with it.
I think that is a great point. You know, we say we conflate what they say with what they believe. And these are two separate things. That's what makes them particular cowards.
Yep. Bob says, unenrolled voters or nonpartisan people from the plurality of voters in the United States. If 38% of Republicans or almost 4 in 10 support voting rights and 82% of Democrats do, it's reasonable to assume that unenrolled voters skew toward a majority support. Those who oppose it, looking at the whole population, are probably about 25%. Polls based on party enrollment are inherently misleading, says Bob.
Yeah, Rosemary's made this point, though, that the Republicans very effectively have taken control of many state legislatures, and that's where this is all happening, and that's the scary part.
And it's worth noting that they have a systemic advantage in that if you just look at the population in the states that are red versus the states that are blue, you find that they can control the country with actually a minority of the vote. And have been. And
exactly.
So, you know, it's and they're trying to keep that advantage and make it more to them. And the way they're doing it is scary. And
it is,
you know, very anti-American. But, you know, that's what they're doing. And, you know, this is how we got into a civil war. And we're now doing it in the ballot box.
Alan?
No, I agree completely. This is we find a big dissonance between what Republican leaders say and what they believe. We see it in the polls versus what we are seeing done in state legislatures. Look, people play this game as if they mean it. And, you know, the legislatures will now deal with the gerrymandering and make it work for themselves, and it'll continue the way that it's going. I mean, it's not hopeless, but it really takes a lot of attention.
John writes this letter and says, if the Republicans are becoming a smaller party of fanatics, what happens when they can't win elections? Do they become a pool for terrorism to thrive in?
No, but that's what happened in the New York State Legislature. You know, they had control of the Senate for what really were hundreds of years. And what ended up happening were 100 years. And what ended up happening is they just ran out of people. And that was the end for them. They could gerrymander. They had the state Senate districts all set up. It was done by computer until one day the great computer on the wall turned around, looked them in the eye and said, sorry, Joe Bruno or whoever they were talking to at the time, we just haven't got enough bodies to move around in the gerrymander.
Mm.
And that was the end.
All right.
I would say that, you know, again, I occasionally channel Malcolm Nance, and I would just say, you know, he would have answered that question with a resounding yes. And that's his big fear is that, you know, these frustrated because it doesn't take very many people to be a frustrated minority with guns.
He would have
to do some serious damage.
But he would have said it louder than you did. Go ahead.
But to refer to Rosemary, look, they are playing with a different set of values than the Democrats are. The Democrats say, okay, we're going to do it right, we'll do it fairly, and they say we'll take every advantage of everything we can, and we'll play it dirty.
Yes, yes. They have done that since 2000 and the Bush Gore. I'm forgetting his name. The Bush Gore election. They violated every principle they had in that election about whether states or the courts or the federal courts, especially, should be in charge of elections, because that was their game plan to win. And Gore took that very principled statement, like stand that, you know, I'm going to do this for the sake of the country, and it was all very noble and lovely. But it's wow.
They wouldn't have done
it. Game of Thrones, you know. No, of course not. It's like Game of Thrones. That's so predictive of our system, where if you have honor and principle, you end up with your head cut off.
Red
and
wedding.
That's happening.
Yeah. Okay, we have just a couple of minutes here, so let's go to the bonus round. I'd like to talk about the New York Times editorial board. They are endorsing Catherine Garcia for mayor of New York, New York, saying her ideas and experience stand out in a crowded field of Democratic hopefuls. I will say the last time we discussed this issue of the mayoral race, at least on this particular program, we were talking about the very high poll numbers for one Andrew Yang. Those numbers have gone down substantially, and now the editorial board of the Times is endorsing Catherine Garcia. Alan, your thoughts on this race?
Well, they can't endorse the leader, Adams, who comes from Brooklyn, who is of color, and who, interestingly, was a cop and is very pro-law and order. And he is leading in the polls right now, which may show you something of what New Yorkers are thinking. And so it becomes any man's race. I don't think this – well, let's put it this way. Garcia is a Spanish, Hispanic name. Adams has clearly got an awful lot of the black vote, and it's an interesting discussion, although I suspect we haven't got time for it, in which a lot of people think that people of color are not for law and order. Wrong, because they are the ones who get hit on the most in all of this. So somehow he's put it together so that Adams has, so that he's working both ways. Garcia, of course, will get Hispanic votes. I think the Times endorsement here is less important than it might have been in other places.
So the we have a few minutes that we can discuss this, but Eric Adams, that you mentioned, Alan, the former police captain who fought for reform. There's also Sean Donovan, who was in the Obama and Bloomberg administrations. Catherine Garcia, who was the one who was endorsed by the Times, a civil servant who wants to improve everyday life. Ray McGuire, a former Wall Street executive and has made a big issue of jobs in the campaign. Diane Morales, a nonprofit leader who is looking for a spotlight on issues of the poor and working class. Scott Stringer, who has come under some fire recently for past activities, the city controller with a progressive vision for New York. Maya Wiley, the civil rights attorney who's working on inequality. And of course, Andrew Yang, the former entrepreneur and presidential candidate who is looking to shake up things in the Big Apple. So those are the candidates. It's a very big field, isn't it, Mike Spain?
It is, and I think the rules are new now, aren't they, Alan? That there's going to be a runoff. They have to get a certain percentage, or if you know, one of these complicated algorithms and how you vote and who comes in second, depending on who comes in first, and you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, as they say in law school to the professor when he calls on them with a question that they don't know the answer to, I'm not prepared, professor.
right. But it is going.
But I know in the general, election, you're absolutely right.
But in this primary, it's It's one of those crazy ones, like
it's
they have
ranked
in different
choice
states.
Voting, right? Ranked choice voting.
Ranked choice in the regular election. I know that.
Yeah, well, it is in the primary too, I guess.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
And that'll winnow it down a little bit, and then
I don't live there anymore.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But I think it's going to surprise people. Whatever happens on primary day, it's going to surprise people, and probably and there may be another shock coming. Andrew Yang was very popular.
I'm betting he was because they knew who he was.
Yeah,
and I'm betting that Adams is going to be the winner, but we'll see.
Jim,
I just want to say
ahead.
That the New York Times,
Rosemary.
Okay, the New York Times has a terrible record with endorsements. They seem to pick the women and then they do terrible. If you remember the presidential election, it was they picked the two women senators, neither of whom went on to even get the nomination, much less to be president. So I'm glad they're promoting women. And this woman, she was just the name in the also runnings for to me before this endorsement. I read about her. It's fascinating. Garcia is in charge of a gigantic, mostly male department and sanitation. And they're saying that qualifies her to be the mayor because she can run a big, giant bureaucracy. I think that's a fine idea. I personally like Andrew Yang and I love Maya Wiley, but I could go for her. So great.
Jim Henler.
Wait.
Oh, go ahead, Alan. Go ahead.
No, I was just commenting on what
Rosemary said. Oh, I thought you said wait. I'm sorry.
No, she said, so wait. Right.
Yeah.
We have to wait.
Yeah,
that's
we have
what
to
election's
wait.
About.
Jim.
All I can add is, boy, I think it's a really strong group. And, you know, when you describe them, I'm like, you know, I wish that was the national elections we were talking about with that many
people. Was that a comment on Albany?
I said national. I was careful there. Oh.
Although. It's interesting, Alan, your thoughts of how important this is for the rest of us who live in New York State, and of course our audience goes to seven states, but for I think everyone on this panel lives in New York, except for you, Alan. But
yes,
how important is the mayor of New York in the scheme of things?
Well, it's pretty important because we have seen there was a bloodlust between Cuomo and de Blasio. And de Blasio is largely seen as been terribly ineffective and not a great mayor. So this could be a sea change. Now, I happen to believe that Andrew Cuomo has a philosophy which is basically, if you're not me, you're not good. So so therefore.
Well, I was actually just going to ask you that question. If you're Andrew Cuomo, assuming you're not going to endorse anybody, who are you going to vote for? And yeah, is it just none of the above that because you're just not going to get along with whoever gets the job?
Well, I do believe that, yes. I believe that Cuomo won't get along with anybody who is the mayor of New York. I think he sees that as a central dividing line. Who's got the power? I do or the mayor does. We all know that a central principle of political science is that the city is a creature of the state. And he pulls that card a lot.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. It's wonderful to have you all here. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Great pleasure. Thanks to our wonderful group. Mike Spain, always good to hear your voice. Rosemary, thank you. Jim, I hope you get email back. And I wish you.
But not too soon.
No, that's right. Enjoy your silence for a while. And as long as I now have a way to get a hold of you, I don't really, whatever works. We look forward to having you back. And thanks for coming in the last minute and helping us out and informing us this morning. I greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks to the whole group. We will be back right after this.